two college radio DJs during the 90s, hosts Keith and Steve, helped expose bands like Nirvana, Pavement, and PJ Harvey. They went to shows, interviewed musicians, and reviewed albums for various zines and papers. They worked security at concerts and once even did load-in for Phish. Now, they're dads. Whether you want to explore lesser-known music or take a trip down memory lane, tune into the new Dad Rock. Join hosts Keith and Steve as they navigate the ages together, sharing their love of music across various eras and genres. Always well-intentioned, often well-informed, seldom boring, the new Dad Rock will expand your mind.
Welcome to the new Dad Rock.
I don't know how new it is anymore.
Welcome to the new Dad Rock.
Dude, that would have been good last episode. Or the episode before that. The Halloween one. Remember that one?
Yes, and I was afraid of a vampire, and now one's gotten me. Ha ha ha!
Wait. Yeah.
Hey,
what is a werewolf sound like? Okay, I guess so. Oh, man. So I subscribe to things on YouTube, and I watch YouTube on my phone, and I look at YouTube every day to find the latest music and all that, and I saw that Duran Duran was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in the last day or two. Or at least the video was uploaded in the last day or two.
So that was the new thing that you found in music, Duran Duran?
Duran Duran being inducted into the Hall of Fame.
Got you. Yeah, so the Hall of Fame and Duran Duran. That's I guess, pretty incredible. How many good albums did Duran Duran have?
Yeah, that's a tricky one. Were you not a Duran Duran fan ever?
It wasn't really. I mean, obviously, I grew up in the 80s, so I knew of them and could not. Their songs were ubiquitous. And my, I had this girlfriend who had Rio, like an album cover, painted in her basement.
That's what I was about to say.
She had done it. She had painted it.
That's amazing. Yeah. I was about to say that, like, it's like everyone's girlfriend or the girls that you like that maybe didn't like you back, like Duran Duran. In fact, part of the acceptance speech, so each of them spoke during the acceptance speech, and one of them told the story about how they played a party at some big... Oh, no. Robert Downey Jr. was the person who did their, like, pre-induction speech. And he talked about how they played some party back in the day and some famous producer's wife took her bra off and threw it at the band, like, 30, 40 years later.
Well, this is after a family show, dude.
Wait. I mean, bras are supporting. Supportative. Right. Anyway, moral of the story is that, like, Duran Duran, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They played three songs during their set before they gave the speech, and it was Girls on Film, Hungry Like a Wolf, and Ordinary World.
Ordinary World. That was one of the later ones, right?
Totally.
Like in the 90s? I mean, was that 90s?
Yeah, absolutely. But I actually... So when I moved to the East Coast, for whatever reason, I'd go to Barnes & Noble's, and I would like look for biographies or autobiographies of bands.
Wait, what year did you move to the East Coast and you went to Barnes & Noble?
2022? This year?
Wait, there are still Barnes & Nobles, for real?
Dude, in Pennsylvania.
Wow.
Well, in fact, so I tend to go to local bookstores, but they don't have big music biography sections. In fact, they don't have music sections.
Hmm.
So, and I don't think I'd search on Amazon for it, because it's not, like, when you search on Amazon, it's just, like, lists, right? But, like, when you're in a bookstore, there's a shelf. Or actually, the one I go to in Plymouth Meeting, about 15 minutes away, is like four bookshelves of biographies of music. So I'll just scan them and look for some. And, well, I came across a Duran Duran one. I think it's called Please, Please Help Me Now. Or no, Please, Please Tell Me Now. Yeah, so from one of their songs. And so I got that. It was pretty good. But it did, I always like the origin story of the band, and it's interesting to hear what the band thought of what they were doing, because, I mean, I was, what, like 9? You know, when the band, like, they were kind of associated with MTV because they do the crazy videos.
Yeah. They had some, as they say, risque videos that were even banned.
Totally. Like, I mean, Girls on Film is actually, like, they actually, like, flew to Sri Lanka and, like, almost died when they're filming it. Like, they were like, yeah, we'll go to Sri Lanka and film a video. And this is, like, 80, 81. Like, it's not easy to go to Sri Lanka.
Those big major labels that had the budget, and they're like, we have $50,000 to spend on this
No. It was like $1 million even in those days.
Yeah, $50,000 a day probably.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And they hated being an MTV band. Or, I'm sure they appreciate when it worked, but then later on they were upset by it. But it's a good book. Talks about how the band got together pretty young. Origin story. The clubs they were in.
Much every biography. Grew up, how it influenced you, how you got there.
Yeah, but it's a band that you listen to, so it's kind of fun to hear about.
And sometimes there are more interesting stories than not. Like, some bands, they're like, oh, we got together and started playing, and immediately we were popular, and then blah, blah.
I gotta say that I feel that the ones I read, like, in Duran Duran's 2, is like, a lot of it is the early part, and then all of a sudden, like, the last 30 years when they have a couple albums, like, an album every 5-6 years, it's pretty quick, like the last 3 chapters.
Yeah, but, exactly. It's like, and they lived happily ever after.
So Duran Duran was one of the ones I got.
They have the big thing at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame that they announced, like, Andy Taylor has cancer or something?
That's exactly what we're talking about. Yeah, yeah.
But you didn't mention that at all, did you?
Well, it's a downer, man. You and I both turned 50 this year. Well, I'm sorry. You turned 50 this year. I turned 50 next year. But, like, yeah, man, that's really sad. He's had it for 4 years, and he couldn't fly to the show, but he appreciates all the fans. It's a serious show here.
So, did you read any other books? I mean, we already did a whole episode on books. Remember, I think we talked about
Pavement's book.
Yeah.
We talked about the whole series of books,
the 33 and a third, and mm-hmm. How John Darnielle writes fiction now. But I think one of the things I mentioned was I read a bunch of biographies, and one of them I mentioned was Tom Petty, and I think the one by Warren Zanes. I think you read.
I got it after I got the Duran Duran one. Actually, I think I bought it the same time I got the Duran Duran one. So I read the Tom Petty one. It's amazing. The Tom Petty one's interesting because I feel you don't really learn too much about his internal state. You know what I mean? Him personally. I just picked up a Phil Collins one, which is funny enough called I'm Not Dead Yet, which, you know, is a pretty good title. And the Phil Collins one is interesting because he was in so much of it. The half the book is before he's even in Genesis. And then, like, you know, he's famous as Phil Collins, you know, after Genesis, or at the same time in the early 80s. So the Phil Collins one's interesting because it's really him writing it. But the first one that got me into all this, and it's not a band or a person I really listened to when I was younger, but for whatever reason, I actually bought it at Barnes & Noble's in Massapequa when I was home in June before I got my place, was Johnny Marr's book. I think it's called Set the Boy Free. It's an autobiography.
Yeah, it's an autobiography. So he himself actually wrote it and not with a ghostwriter.
Well, I bet he had someone
writing it. I don't know. From interviews, it sounded like he put the time in and he did it. Like, he marked the time off in his schedule. Because one of the things I've come to learn about him, and maybe you can fill us more on this, is, I mean, he's known as the guitarist of the Smiths, which lasted, 5 years? And then some people probably know he played guitar with Modest Mouse, but what many people may not know is he formed other bands like Electronic. He was in The for a number of years. He did session work with Talking Heads, so he was a busy guy. He, you know, produced albums. He did one-offs with people like Beck. So he was...
Is.
It is, yeah, he's still doing it. And I think what he did, he made his schedule, and he's like, all right, I have this 18 months. And, you know, he's a guy that runs marathons at this point, so he was able to, I think, put the discipline and the work in. At least that's what he says. That's the story he gives.
It's a pretty good story, not a story that I expect from a rock star. I mean, he does mention that, he was in the Smiths pretty early. He's very... driven when you read the story. Like, a lot of these books, they talk about their teen years a lot more than I would have expected.
Right.
Also, apparently in England, when you're 18, you've already been like an adult for 4 years.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. So Johnny Marr grew up in Manchester and started playing guitar when he was like 14 years old. Like, the guy from the band The Cult, the guitarist, was like a couple years older than him at the next school. So he's like, oh, I'm going to be like that guy. And he formed, I think, the Smiths, but that was like his fifth band, and he was like 17 or 18 years old.
Yeah, and I think actually he had his first guitar when he was 6 or 8. And he doesn't know why. Like, he saw it in a storefront, and his parents got it for him, and it was a clunker, but he played it. Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. Actually, you know what's interesting about every one of these ones, except for Tom Petty, 3 of the 4 are all English bands from the 80s. For some reason, apparently you write a biography when you're 40 years older than when you started. So everything's from the 80s. But Johnny Marr's thing was interesting because the Smiths was a band that apparently must have been broken up by the time I was listening to this music, right? Because mid-80s. They're probably broken up by then. But all the girls that I liked or that I was like kind of hanging out with, this was one of their favorite bands. I never really got into the Smiths. That's why when I saw the book, when I saw it was an autobiography, I'm like, yeah, you know, I'm going to buy it because I know nothing about this guitarist. And I'm, as a guitarist, I was like, how come I know nothing? And I knew he worked with Modest Mouse.
Well, that's the thing about Johnny Marr as a guitarist, and you might not know it, but when you hear a Smiths song, you hear the guitar riff, you hear that wall of sound, you hear the jangly chords, you know it's a Smiths song. And that sound that he puts in, once you know the other songs that he's worked on, especially the ones with Modest Mouse or even a collaboration with Talking Heads, when you hear his guitar ringing out, you know it's him. He has a unique sound.
Yeah, no, he really likes the sound element of it as well. He talks about, he actually sort of sought out Morrissey, right? Like, he was looking for a singer to go with his band. It wasn't a band, it was him. And they were going to form a band, but he's looking for a singer, a partner. And, you know, he knew Morrissey through someone of someone of someone.
Yeah, he was in another band at the time.
Sure. And then they're 17, 18, like you said. He takes the bus over there, you know, his... Morrissey's mom answers it. They go upstairs. They listen to the same, they listen to some records together. They talk. They wrote a song the first day. I forget which one it was. But obviously, Morrissey already had lyrics and, you know, Johnny Marr already had a guitar riff. But, like, they put a song together the first day. It's too bad that their breakup was so acrimonious.
Yeah, well, we'll get into that in a minute. But before that, it's funny that you say he sought out a singer. And if you hear, I mean, Johnny Marr still continues to play. He does solo work. He does a lot of session work, but his solo work when he tours as Johnny Marr, he plays a number of Smith songs in the set, and he sounds a lot like Morrissey the way he sings it. And maybe
so,
it's
I don't
just
know
it.
If Morrissey's voice is necessarily easy to copy as much as that. Like, you've heard the song and he's singing the song. It's like karaoke for him. I don't mean that as derogatory.
Right.
I think the hard part was coming up with the lyrics and the weird melody.
Yeah,
right? Like, the way it's sung is the hard part. You're right. The voice itself is actually, like, is not the hard part. The hard part is, like, how did you come up with lyrics that went that way?
Yeah.
They're just such weird songs.
And you know it's not Morrissey, but they just have a similar sounding voice. So.
Yeah, totally. He would end his set with a couple songs of theirs. And, in fact, he toured with... Who did he tour with? Was it New Order? No, he toured with someone in the last, like, 6 months where... he would come back out with the other band and they'd do 2 songs at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always the same couple of songs, Smith songs. But right. It must be awesome to have written like 2 songs, 3 songs that everyone loves, everyone wants to play, everyone wants to hear. I mean, that must be so amazing.
Yeah, and like you said, it's great that they have that, and it's sad that, you know, they broke up only after 5 years, but maybe that's for the best because you have that fond memory of those, you know, whatever, 5-ish albums that came out, and it's there. If they come back, how can they live up to the hype?
So what happens is after the Smiths, or even maybe during the Smiths, like what happens, he retreats, you know, he has his fun year or two in London, you know, partying or whatever. He's been with the same girl since they were 18.
And he's like 21 years old now at this point.
Yeah, oh yeah, totally. But they get a house kind of out of town of Manchester. But what he always loved doing was making music. So he creates a studio in his house. That's how he ends up with the or the Healers or working with the Talking Heads, is because basically people come to his house. You know, he's hanging out. He's got a studio and he likes making music. So people come there and hang out.
The other band that he was in for, I guess, 2 or 3 years was Modest Mouse in the mid-2000s, which... I mean, I was a big Modest Mouse fan then, and when that came out that Johnny Marr was joining the band, I was like, okay, it didn't even make a lot of sense to me.
I agree.
But it worked. And look, that's probably, you know, that's the last good the last great Modest Mouse album. You know, we were dead before we sank, the boat sank.
The ship.
The ship, the boat, we,
dude,
the
podcast. I actually agree. So, totally, last episode ever. And what's interesting is the way he talks about in his book how he got a call from a friend. He liked Modest Mouse. He actually liked American guitar music at that point because the Brit pop stuff that was happening in the early 2000s wasn't his thing. So he's excited by the vitality. Like, I think the Yeah Yeah Yeahs was the band he mentions. Mm-hmm. And so he gets a call. Do you want to play with them? And he's like, okay, cool. I'll fly to Portland and I'll jam with Isaac. They speak for a second. Isaac Brock, the lead singer of Modest Mouse. And he goes and he stops listening to Modest Mouse because he wants to bring something original at that point. So he goes there. He gets to his hotel. Isaac picks him up, drives back to his place, and they grab their guitars, and apparently Isaac's sitting like 2 feet in front of him. They're facing each other. Isaac plugs into like the biggest, loudest amp ever, gets out a jug of wine, and he starts playing, and then Isaac's like, you got any riffs? And he plays a riff, and then Isaac puts on like goggles and an aviator cap, and they wrote a song or two that very night. I forget off the top of my head what songs they were, but I think it's, oh, is it Dashboard? And,
yeah, well, Dashboard to me, it has that, it sounds like Modest Mouse and it sounds like the Smiths. You just clearly hear that ringing. His guitar is so unmistakable when you know it's him.
Yeah. Okay. But it's, let me just read a paragraph. All right, let's see. Isaac put on a 1940s flying cap and goggles, and halfway through playing, he stopped and came 3 inches up to my face and asked, got any riffs? I liked his directness, no messing around, and I did have a riff. It was something I'd been playing in Morocco that was funky and jerky, and I had started to play it. Something about playing the Fender Jaguar, and this is a guitar that he grabbed off Isaac's shelf. Isaac grabbed the mic and started singing words from straight out of the air. Well, it should have been, could have been, worse than you could ever know. The dashboard melted, but we still had the radio. And then he reeled off a stream of verses about a car tearing down a mountain with bits falling off, but it was all okay because we still had the radio.
He was just there initially thinking that he was going to consult, maybe help write a couple songs.
That's right.
And then ultimately he wrote some songs, and then he liked them so much he said, I want to record them. So he recorded them with the band, and then after the recording process, he's like, all right, I love these songs, let's go on tour. And he, you know, 3 years later, he's in Modest Mouse for a few years, a couple tours, and an album and an EP.
Yeah. I gotta say, the most unique thing about all this is how he becomes a runner. In his book, I mean, this also happened to Haruki Murakami, the Japanese novelist. At some point, he becomes a runner. He even wrote a book about what I think about when I'm running.
Yeah, Murakami.
But like halfway through this book, halfway through this book, Johnny Marr is like, you know, he stops drinking or whatever. He wakes up at the crack of dawn. And he starts jogging. And like every chapter halfway through the book, he's like, I was in Portland hanging out. And I wake up and I jog around Portland. It was beautiful. And then he's like, at the recording sessions, he's like, I think they were in Mississippi or something. He's like, I'd wake up and I'd go jog. I'm just like, it's just so weird. Because joggers are so, they're practically religious.
Yeah. He thought it was, you know, kind of an oxymoron. And I saw an interview with him. It was him, Isaac Brock, and Tony Hawk was like hosting it. And it was the three of them, so obviously it was the time he was in Modest Mouse, and it was just before he joined Modest Mouse, which I think was 2006-ish.
Yeah, so, that sounds right.
You know, he's in his late 30s at that point, I guess, 40-ish.
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, he wanted to take up running to be a more respectable, you know, working man, which he is. He's a hardworking guy. He's always a session musician, a producer, a songwriter. He's been a member of various bands throughout the decade.
He was a vegetarian since Meat is Murder or before.
Yeah, well, between Morrissey and his wife, they, and the fact that he's on a tour for Meat is Murder, he couldn't very well eat a bacon sandwich or something.
Oh, man. Well, he looks pretty good. He's lasted really long. I mean, if I was a guitarist of fate, that I guess I should start running and be a vegetarian.
There's still hope for you yet, Keith.
I don't know. I don't have my early career Smiths period.
Yeah.
I mean, unless you count Squirt Crap.
Yeah, I like you said, so my wife, Kristen, she liked the Smiths growing up. And I listened to them, and like I said, you always know it's them. you know, not just because of Morrissey's...
You always know it's them, yeah.
...breezy, but, you know, troubled vocals, and... But there's something so sunny, and, you know, Morrissey's singing about these, you know, horrible, depressing things, and the guitar underneath is so excited and hopeful and yearning almost. It's probably what made the Smiths great, was the juxtaposition, the sweet and sour.
I remember from MTV, Girlfriend in a Coma, I know, was like kind of the most popular song I ever remember of theirs. But actually a song off the same album, A Rush and a Push, A Rush and a Push and Land is Ours, that's my favorite song by theirs right now. Actually, it's my favorite song of theirs after I read the book. Not because I read the book, but because I listened to them a bunch after I read the book. And their last album is the one I like the best.
Yeah. It's always good to go out on a high note. You know, Velvet mm-hmm. Underground went out with Loaded. And you can say their legacy was a little bit diminished or tarnished because they came back in the 90s and got together, and it was kind of like a dud. So maybe it makes sense that Morrissey and Johnny Marr don't get back together.
I forgot about Oasis. I don't know if you read the whole Johnny Marr book, but basically one of the last chapters, he talks about how a friend's like, come out to this band. He sees this band in front of 10 people. And he's like, this band is awesome. And he's like, who are these people? Like, it's a pretty good chapter. It turns out the band was Oasis. He saw them 3 or 4 times in front of like 20 or 30 people. He actually put his management team onto them. But he saw them when they were like playing for 10 or 20 people, which is how cool is that? You're Johnny Marr, super famous. This is you're from the Smiths, and you're just going around town and you're still seeing bands that are only playing to 10 or 20 people.
Well, that underscores how into... Music. The whole yeah. thing, and he was just really into music, and all he wanted to do was play guitar and learn about music and hear other cool totally. Music.
I think you can see him on tour in 2023. I think he has a new song coming out soon, too.
Excellent.
Good luck, Johnny Marr.
Johnny Marr, the new dad rock.